half an empty hotel is better than one with a few stray guests like it was in the spring, but it's not enough. Both Fairbrook and Marquis had to lay off and furlough staff, ask banks to defer payments, and apply for federal pandemic loans to help pay wages.
Many of our hotels were probably at the last one or two payroll cycles left in that.
Now it's been 6 months of loan deferrals, and banks are getting antsy. There are still taxes, water and electric bills. Both Patels are dipping into personal funds, hoping lawmakers manage to pass new financial relief. Trade groups say without it, a wave of hotel foreclosures is inevitable. Here's Vinay Patel again.
The problem is that looking ahead in the next 6 months, and I don't mean to stereotype, but the winter is coming on. You know, one of the shows you said it, the winter is busy, is coming.
The Game of Thrones joke cuts deep because winter is when many hotels go dormant in the best of times, which makes it an even stranger moment to be staffing up and furnishing brand new properties. Actual dates and plans are still in flux, but like the proverbial show, a hotel opening must go on. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the KTOO newsroom, I'm Pablo Arauz Peña, and I have a local and statewide news update just for you. Counting for the 2020 census ends today. That's following a Supreme Court ruling earlier this week that allows the federal government to end the count early. Gabe Lehman is head of the Alaska Census Working Group.
The decision by the Supreme Court is really disappointing for all Alaskans. The way in which the census count was affected in Alaska was really significant, particularly in our most rural and remote communities. And the additional time to count individuals in those communities would have made a tremendous difference to our state.
It has been a difficult year for the count to take place. The deadline has been changed several times, and the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted outreach and in-person operations, which is a big deal for places like rural Alaska.
In light of those challenges, it makes no sense whatsoever to terminate the census operations early. If anything, the federal government should acknowledge those challenges and work exceptionally hard to do whatever it can to make up for them. And that means extending operations so that they can be done thoughtfully, carefully, and safely.
Lehman encourages any Alaskans who haven't yet filled out their census to do so by the end of the day today. It takes about 5 minutes. More than 17,000 Alaskans' absentee ballots have already been returned to the State Division of Elections. That's as of yesterday. That leaves hundreds of thousands who still have a chance to vote. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman spoke with Alaska News Nightly host Casey Grove about how Alaskans can cast their ballots.
Okay, Andrew, can you first remind us how many different ways people can vote?
Yeah, there are three main ways: absentee, early in-person, and in-person on election day. Let's take those one at a time. You have to request an absentee ballot, and the deadline to apply is October 24th. The Division of Elections must receive it by then, so Alaskans would be wise to apply by mail a few days before then, or they can apply online. There have been roughly 115,000 applications so far. That's more than a third of the total number of votes cast in Alaska in the last presidential election. The way it works is you get the ballots either by mail or electronically, you fill in the ballot, and then you sign it and provide personal identifying information. That's either your voter number, driver's license number, birth date, or part of your social security number. Absentee voters don't need a witness as a result of a state Supreme Court ruling on Monday, but they still need to sign the envelope and provide the personal identifier. Under state law, their vote won't count if they don't do that. The state doesn't have to notify voters that their ballot was rejected until late January. Then there's early voting. That's where you go in person to places designated in each community. That will start in many places next Monday, October 19th. There's a list of early voting locations with the exact days and times it's available in each community, all listed on the Division of Elections website. Finally, Alaskans can vote in person on election day. There are some extra safety precautions this year, like spacing out voting booths to maintain social distancing.
There's been more attention on absentee voting than in previous years, in part because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There's also some confusion about what's different and what's still required of voters. Could you help sort some of that out?
It's been a lot, Casey. President Trump has criticized elections that are conducted entirely by mail or where all voters receive absentee ballots. But he also supports absentee ballot systems that require voters to apply. There have been lawsuits related to absentee ballot access all over the country. There have been multiple lawsuits in Alaska. One was resolved on Monday when the Alaska Supreme Court said absentee voters don't need witnesses to sign their ballots. But again, voters still need to sign it and provide identifying information. There's a second lawsuit that seeks to allow voters a chance to fix their ballots if they neglect to sign it or provide an identifier. There will be oral arguments on that case on Thursday. But until there's a change, absentee voters should still sign their ballots and provide identifying information. I want to talk about putting absentee ballots in the mail. The U.S. Postal Service actually sends mail across Alaska to be postmarked in Anchorage if you don't ask for it to be postmarked in person. Mailed absentee ballots must be postmarked by Election Day. So if it's Election Day or even close to Election Day, take your absentee ballot to your post office and ask the clerk to postmark it there and then.
So there's been public concern about making sure there aren't obstacles to voting, but others say if there aren't enough safeguards, there could be fraudulent ballots cast. How would you describe how accessible and safe voting is in Alaska?
A big mark in Alaska's favor is that nearly all Alaskans are registered to vote, in part because of a 2016 ballot measure that passed by a wide margin that allows everyone to register to vote when they register for their permanent fund dividends. And as we've talked about, the Supreme Court removed the witness requirement for this year's election, so that increases access. And the state provides voter assistance in several Alaska Native languages, as well as in Spanish and Filipino or Tagalog. Also, to prevent fraud, the division has that requirement to provide signatures. Election workers check voter signatures against the ones on record.
The so-called Pebble tapes that came out last month revealed how the company talked to potential investors about its sway over elected officials, among other things. The secret recordings also reignited the debate about how Pebble is planning to meet a last-minute federal requirement to offset damages to Bristol Bay's wetlands. AZ Ross with Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
The Pebble tapes renewed scrutiny of the state's alleged involvement in helping the Pebble Mine Company meet a final requirement for a critical federal permit. First, a quick refresher. Construction of the mine would damage nearly 3,000 acres of wetlands and nearly 130 miles of streams in Bristol Bay's Coctuli River watershed. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers told the company at the end of August that its plan has to include improving parts of the watershed to make up for the damages. That's called compensatory mitigation. In the secretly recorded tapes that came out last month, former CEO Tom Collier said the state of Alaska is key to meeting that requirement.
This mitigation plan that we're putting together, almost all of the land is state land. The state has to be a partner with us, and what we're going to do with that land is we're going to turn it into a preserve. We're going to set it aside, put a conservation easement on it.
But opponents of the mine don't want the state to partner with Pebble on this mitigation plan. House Speaker Bryce Edgman and Representative Louise Stutes wrote a letter to Governor Mike Dunleavy at the end of September asking him to stop working with Pebble on the plan. But so far, Dunleavy hasn't pulled back. Instead, in a letter, he maintained that it is his job as governor to allow for as much responsible development as possible. Over the summer, the Pebble Limited Partnership set up two camps along the Coctuli River to conduct wetland studies about 27 miles away from its base camp at the proposed mine site. Pebble says they were on a native allotment. Alana Hurley is the executive director of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, a group that opposes the mine. She says that Edgman and Stutes were spot on in the request for the state to stop working with Pebble.
None of this is being done with any type of public process, any type of transparency. We had no idea, you know, they were up there until people saw their man camps along the Coctuli.
Company spokesperson Mike Heatwell confirmed that Pebble set up two camps in mid-July to map wetlands in the Coctuli drainage to meet the Corps' new mitigation requirement. He says basing that work away from the village of Iliamna was the best way to protect the community from COVID-19.
We know what they look at soil conditions, map the vegetation, and photograph them, take photographs of the wetlands and all of that, really just to characterize the wetlands in the area. And all of that is getting rolled up into our final compensatory mitigation plan.
Following the release of the Pebble tapes, several Bristol Bay organizations asked the Army Corps for a public comment period on the mitigation plan. Norm Van Vactor, CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, says the Army Corps responded, saying there was no mechanism for additional public comment. For Van Vactor, the Coctuli camp was another example of a lack of transparency in the permitting process.
It confirmed to the rest of us what we've known all along, and that is that Army Corps of Engineers and others have been dealing behind closed doors with the Pebble Partnership and, you know, they've basically been in cahoots with each other.
Not all reactions to Pebble's mitigation efforts are negative. Lisa Reimers is the CEO of Iliamna Development Corporation and a board member of Iliamna Natives Limited, and she supports Pebble. She says she thinks the governor is doing the right thing and that the company is simply following the directions of the Army Corps in its efforts to produce a plan.
I agree with him. You know, mitigation, depending on what the Army Corps is asking, they've been pretty good about their science. I've trusted the whole process that the Army Corps has gone through with Pebble.
Pebble says it will meet the Army Corps' November 18th deadline for submitting the new mitigation plan. A final record of decision on the mine is expected this year. For Alaska's Energy Desk in Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
At xchair.com. From ProQuest, offering a global health and social justice discussion on October 22nd, designed to inspire hope through action. Registration is at ProQuest.com.